Welcome to Back to Basics with Pastor Brian Broderson, an outreach ministry of Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, California. This program is designed to take you back to basic principles for living found in the Word of God.
So hey everybody, turn up your radio. Listen to your soul cry the question why song makes you wonderful. Or something you never seen before.
Pastor Brian is currently teaching from the book of Romans and will be continuing today with part one of Without Excuse. So let's turn in our Bibles to Romans chapter 1, verse 19, as Pastor Brian takes us back to basics.
We're looking at Paul's assertion that the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. And we zeroed in on that particular point in our previous study. We saw that ungodliness is any failure to live entirely to the glory of God, and unrighteousness is any failure to live right according to God's definition of right declared in His Word. We also saw that far from man not knowing right from wrong, man suppresses what he knows to be right in order to do what he knows to be wrong. And for this is condemned. Now, remember, once again, Paul in this first section of the epistle, it's important, I'll remind you of this over and over again because it's just so important to keep this in mind. In this first section of the epistle, Paul is really God's chief prosecutor, building the case against humanity to show our absolute need for the gospel. You know, if I think I'm okay, then I'm not going to seek out any help, am I? If I think that I'm perfectly healthy, I'm never going to go to a doctor. If I think I'm perfectly safe, I'm never going to look for someone to deliver me or save me. If I don't have any concept that I'm lost, I'm certainly not going to be all that concerned about whether I'm found or not. We've got to see ourselves as hopeless, helpless, lost people before we're ever going to cry out for a Savior. Before we're ever going to appreciate the gospel, we've got to understand the depth of our desperate condition. And so, again, that's what he's doing. He's building this case. He is acting as God's chief prosecutor and building the case against humanity. So, having said that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, in verses 19 and 20, Paul gives an example of how men suppress the truth and thereby shows why all men are without excuse for their unbelief and disobedience to God's law. So listen to what he says. So having spoken of those who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, he says this, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and divine nature, so that they are without excuse. So he shows us here. He says men suppress the truth in unrighteousness, and now he just points to an example of how people do that. They do that by refusing to respond properly to the evidence that God has instilled within us as his creatures and surrounded us with through the creation, instead of doing the thing that God would expect us to do as responsible, reasonable creatures, we do the exact opposite. Instead of looking at the creation and saying, oh, there must be a creator, and the creator must have a will, and therefore I must humbly seek for that creator. Instead of doing that, man looks around at creation and comes up with all kinds of other irrational types of theories about what it is or how it got here. And so in these two verses here, verses 19 and 20, Paul lays out truths that would later in history become the basis for what we call the moral and the teleological arguments for God's existence. Teleological, referring to the ideas of design and purpose. So in verse 19, first, notice where Paul starts. He says, because what may be known of God is manifest in them. Now, the word in could be translated among. So I want to look at it from the standpoint of God manifesting in us this knowledge of his existence. And how is the existence of God manifested within man, within the very being of man, within the very nature and heart of man? How is that the case? Well, we see this manifestation of the knowledge of God in the universal sense of right and wrong. Everyone throughout all of time has essentially understood right from wrong, and everyone throughout all of time has, generally speaking, agreed on what is right and what is wrong. C.S. Lewis put it this way in Mere Christianity. He said, the law or rule about right and wrong used to be called the law of nature. The law was called the law of nature because people thought that everyone knew it by nature and did not need to be taught it. And, he said, I believe they were right. I know that some people say the idea of a law of nature or decent behavior known to all men is unsound because different civilizations and different ages have had quite different moralities. But, says Lewis, this is not true. There have been differences between their moralities, but these have never amounted to anything like a total difference. If anyone will take the trouble to compare the moral teachings of, say, the ancient Egyptians, Babylonians, Hindus, Chinese, Greeks, and Romans, what will really strike him will be how very like they are to each other and to our own. These, then, are the two points I want to make, he says. First, that human beings all over the world have this curious idea that they ought to behave in a certain way and cannot really get rid of it. Secondly, that they do not, in fact, behave that way. They know the law of nature, yet they break it. These two facts are the foundation of all clear thinking, Lewis says, about ourselves and the universe we live in. So it's a universal fact. Everybody knows intuitively, instinctively, the difference between right and wrong. You have to actually educate people against what they know to be true to bring them to a point of embracing the idea that there is no such thing as right or wrong, or there are no universal absolutes or anything like that. Now, Frank Drown and Marie, his wife, they went many, many years ago down to Ecuador. And they ministered in the jungles in Ecuador among the Shuara people. And when Frank tells the story of the ministry down there, in one of the stories that he tells, he uses this text right here to launch into the story. And he asks this question. Now, these were primitive people. They were people that had never come into contact with the gospel. And so Frank, as he begins his lecture on this particular point, using these verses here in Romans 1, he asks this question. He says, what do you think the Shuar people knew? What do you think they knew in regard to, you know, things spiritual, things moral, and so forth? And then he says this. He says they knew a lot more than you would think they know. And he said that he himself learned from them that they absolutely knew that there were things that were right and there were things that were wrong. And they also knew that for doing wrong things, they would be judged. Amazing. Up until their coming to them, no one had ever brought the Mosaic Law. No one had ever brought the gospel. But they knew in themselves what was right, what was wrong. And it was basically the same kind of stuff that we would know to be right and wrong. Now, atheistic or people who are anti-God, anti-Bible in the realm of sociology or whatever, they would say that we only think things are right and wrong because we've been conditioned to think things are right and wrong. So we think certain behaviors are wrong because we've had this imposed on us from the outside, they say. But what happens when they come up against a person or a group of people that have never had any outside influence imposing any moral standard on them, and they find that within the hearts of the people, there is this sense, this understanding of right and wrong. Of course, they deny that is, you know, even possible, but there's plenty of evidence to prove that it's true. Now, here's the point, though. A universal law of right and wrong means what? It means there is a lawgiver. The reason why everybody knows this, the reason why it's instilled there in the heart of every culture that's ever lived is because God put it there. And that's what Paul is arguing here. Men suppress the truth in unrighteousness because that which may be known of God is manifest in them. And so we know, and even we ourselves can perhaps remember back, even as children, knowing that difference. And not simply because we were taught that. There were certain things that we might have been taught were right and wrong, but there were other things that we were never taught were right and wrong, but we just intuitively knew that they were wrong. Now, later in the second chapter, Paul's going to talk about this phenomena among the nations of the world outside of Israel who were living according to the moral law, even though they never had it. Paul said it's evidence that there's still a remnant of God's law written on the heart. So what that seems to infer is that when God created man, he created man with the law written in his heart. And what's happened is that sin has marred that. Sin has darkened that. So we don't see it as we would have seen it had we not sinned, but the traces of it are still there. So, manifested in them. But then he goes on, secondly, and he says, the knowledge of God's existence is also shown to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and divine nature. his invisible attributes. What attributes would those be? Well, of course, it would be the attribute of omnipotence, his power. His power is evidenced in the created world, but also his omniscience, his knowledge, his complete, thorough, total, absolute knowledge of all things that could possibly be known. That would be manifested as well. But also, there would be the manifestation, going back to what we just talked about a moment ago, there would be, to some extent, a manifestation of his holiness because of that sense within us of right and wrong. So, creation, and this is what Paul's pointing to here, obviously, creation means simply and obviously, at least it should be obvious, that there is a creator. Now, Paul, even in his day, says that people rejected the revelation of God through creation. It's not a new thing. It's not something that's just happened as a result of the development of modern science. It is something that happened all the way back, not just in apostolic times, but it's something that's happened all the way back in history. People looking at creation, and instead of concluding the obvious that there must be a creator to whom I'm accountable and so forth, men have rejected that. Trent Douglas, he does a lot of missions ministry in Africa. And Trent is one of those guys who, when he goes to Africa, he wants to go to the places where nobody's gone. So he's looking for people that nobody's ever been into contact with. So in the Sudan, he somehow gets connected with this tribe of people out in the bush that no missionaries have ever been to before. And so he's telling the story that as they come to them, you know, it's kind of humorous as he's kind of showing how he was communicating, but they are so primitive and their language is so, well, just such an isolated language. It took four translators to finally get out what they were trying to communicate back and forth. But what they were there to do, of course, was to share the gospel, to tell them about the true God. And so in talking to the chief of the tribe, this is what the chief told him. Again, no Bibles, no missionaries, nobody's ever come to them and brought them the gospel or in anything even close to it. But here's what the chief said. The chief said this: we look at the sky, we look at the sun, at night we look at the moon and the stars, we see the hills, the rivers, the trees, the animals. And this is what he said. He said, we know there is a God, but we don't know who he is or how to worship him. Amazing. Now, this guy, this chief, he has responded properly to God's witness of creation. This is the right response. This is the logical response. This is the obvious response. If there's a creation, there must be a creator. You've got to get a PhD to conclude the opposite of that. You got to get your brain twisted and tweaked with philosophy and just nonsense. You know what I'm saying? It's like, okay, you know, so here's this guy, this chief, out in the bush, and he knows, it's obvious, it's got to be a creator. But you go to Oxford or you go to Harvard or you go to somewhere like that, and, you know, oh, are you kidding? There's no such thing as a creator. And it's amazing that that's where things have come to. So Paul is telling us there's a witness in creation. There's always been a witness in creation. Nature and the complexity of living creatures and systems has been that voice all throughout history speaking to man of the fact that there's a creator. That there's an all-powerful, all-knowing, all-wise creator. Now, in previous generations to the modern era and the development of the scientific method and so forth, obviously people, you know, understood a lot of things, but they didn't have the extent of knowledge that we have today about living systems, organisms, and things like that. They were, you know, to some degree restricted to, you know, just what the naked eye could see. But even being restricted to what the naked eye could see, God says that's plenty. It's plenty of evidence right there to work with. It's plenty of evidence to draw the proper conclusion that there's a creator. And of course, if you want to go back beyond the time when, you know, the microscope was developed and the telescope was developed and all of those kinds of things and all of the various discoveries that have transpired through modern science, if you go back, you still would have, you know, people understanding to some degree, you know, the eyeball maybe or the ear. But even then, their understanding was limited. Darwin's understanding of the eye was limited compared to what we know today, but he still admitted that the eyeball was a stumbling block to his evolutionary theory. So here's my point. If those previous generations of people whose knowledge was limited about the complexity of the creation, if they were held accountable and guilty, how much more accountable and guilty is the present generation? Because the Bible teaches this principle that greater knowledge brings greater responsibility. Greater knowledge sets a person up for a greater judgment. And I believe, and I think we can support it biblically, that the present generation of atheists and agnostics are going to be held more accountable than those prior to the development of modern science. Because now it's all uncovered. It's out there. It's clear. In regard to Darwin theorized that, you know, Darwin didn't bother to try to come up with biogenesis, how life itself began. They just sort of assumed that that was a fairly simple thing because, you know, it was just the development of a simple cell. And in Darwin's day, that's what they thought about a cell, that it was simple. But of course, today we know it's not simple at all. And his point was, you know, Darwin might even, you know, might be a little more gracious to somebody like him because he just assumed simplicity, but he didn't have any way of you know, actually testing that. But today we know that there's no such thing. But even with the tremendous understanding that we have today of the radical complexity of living systems, we still have people drawing the same absurd conclusions. So today we know that life, living systems, and we'll reduce it to cells, are extremely complex. And there are those today that talk about specified complexity and irreducible complexity. Specified complexity refers to the fact that something could only have been specifically designed for the very thing that it does. It could not have randomly developed that way. The design is too specified. It's too specific. You don't get specific, detailed, complicated pieces of machinery accidentally. Those things have to be thought out. They have to be planned out. They have to be drawn up. And then the blueprint has to be followed.
We'll return with more insightful lessons from the book of Romans in our next lesson as Pastor Brian continues with part two of Without Excuse. But right now, I'd like to remind you that if you missed any part of this study, or perhaps you'd like to review it again at a more convenient time, you can do so by simply calling us toll-free at 1-800-733-6443 and request the message entitled Without Excuse. Or if you prefer, simply refer to it by resource number B0107. Once again, our toll-free number is 1-800-733-6443. Pastor Brian would also love to connect with you online, and he can be found at facebook.com/Pastor Brian Broderson, also on Twitter at twitter.com/Brian Broderson. And for those of you that prefer to write, you can address your correspondence to Back to Basics, P.O. Box 8000, Costa Mesa, California, 92628. And when writing or calling, be sure to ask for a free catalog of available resources from Back to Basics, and please include the call letters of this station with your correspondence. You're also invited to visit our website at backtobasicsradio.com, where you can listen to archived messages by Pastor Brian or subscribe to our podcasts. Once again, that's backtobasicsradio.com.
Turn up your radio.
Back to Basics is sponsored by Calvary Chapel of Costa Mesa, California.